Welcome to another convocation on an important subject, an issue of our time which Christians should be speaking of and to and acting in accordance with their Christian faith and viewpoints. I've never introduced a brigadier general before, and also a man who was a chaplain at that. And this morning I wonder just which of the two personalities will emerge. When he came to the airport this morning, I expected to meet him in his jet and that he would wing in here on a clipper and land out here in our nice smooth field. But lo and behold, our Brigadier General came by Ozark. And it was on time. And one of the fellows at the desk told me the only reason it was on time is that there's a Brigadier General on board. Dr. Charlemagne is known everywhere in our church. He's known for speaking his mind and is a man who never gets into trouble. Many of us on our faculty here have sat at his feet and have acclaimed him as a fine New Testament exegete theologian who stays with the text. He is a graduate professor of exegetical theology at St. Louis Seminary, and he is particularly, and this is why the Student Coordinating Council and we were anxious to have him come at this particular time on our campus. He's particularly well-versed and has done a lot of reading, lecturing around the country at schools, various types, bases, and this subject of war and peace. And I'm introducing him this morning, but I'd like to have you know that the Coordinating Council is in this with us. In fact, I think they're going to foot the bill. And I want to say that we're all sponsoring him together. It's part of our new program on campus beginning this year that the word curriculum doesn't mean just what takes in place in the classroom, although this is very and most major part. But then also learning takes place in other areas and such convocations as this. And I believe that in these past days, a good deal of learning and understanding and talk about this issue has taken place in our campus. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce the speaker and say that he will speak during the first hour, and add in the second hour, it will be opened up to questions and discussions, counter statements, any question you want to ask. If you don't agree with his viewpoint, state it. That's what the convocation is for, so we can all make our judgments together. And those of you who really want to be heard can step to that microphone back there to ask your questions or make a statement during the second hour, or you can do it from the floor as you speak loudly. So with these ground rules, we'd like to say welcome, Dr. Charlemagne, and give you a hand.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate the fact of having been invited. The relationship between our two seminaries is very much like that between Lutheran Brotherhood and the Aid Association for Lutherans. I remember the old chairman of the board of directors of Lutheran Brotherhood, whenever he would try to refer to the association in Appleton, he would do it something like this. Now, there's another institution in Appleton, Wisconsin, whose name escapes me at the moment. I've tried to do that with respect to your institution, and I apologize. I'm very delighted to be here and to make this particular presentation. President Peterson is a very cautious man. And when he finally tracked me down at Maxwell Air Force Base a couple of nights ago, he asked very cautiously, "Are you a dove? Are you a hawk?" That's good administration, you know, to find out first. Well, I told him the story of Bob Hope. When Bob Hope received the Sylvanus Thayer Award some years ago at West Point, he said, "I am a hawkish dove, and if I must lay an egg, I'm going to lay it for my country." That seemed to satisfy your president. This title, Graduate Professor of Exegetical Theology, really bothers people. Some have difficulty pronouncing it. Most have difficulty understanding it. And the difficulty is made clear to you in very strange ways occasionally. I was at Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa some weeks ago. And if you are from Iowa, you know that Waverly is 20 miles from anywhere. Ozark Airlines stops at Waterloo, which is 20 miles away. By the way, we have a gag in St. Louis about Ozark. It seems that a plane was coming in some days ago and asked for the time of day, and the tower said... the tower said, "Well, what do you want to know for?" "Well, we want to know what time of day it is." "Well," said the tower, "if you're a military aircraft, it's 1600 hours. If it's American or United, it's 4 o'clock. If you're Ozark, the big hand is on 12 and the little one..." Anyway, this airline flies to Waterloo, Iowa. And I said to the man next to me as we landed in Waterloo, "What do you suppose this thing comes to Waterloo for?" Well, he said, "There's a mental institution up here that needs some attention." And I found out why. I was in Waverly trying to get back to Waterloo. Public transportation is very short up in Waverly toward Waterloo. So my host finally said, "Well, let's try to get a Hertz car," only to discover there's no Hertz agency in the place. So he went to a standard filling station because they always promised to help you. And they did. The man there said, "You're in luck because there's a bus up here from the mental institution in Waterloo. They've been brought up here to get some of this fresh air and some of the smell of the cornfields. And I think if you got on there and didn't make too much moans about it, why, probably they'd take you back." So I sat on the bus. The patients came in and sat down. Finally, the driver came, and to be sure he had everybody on board, he started to count. He said, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then he saw me. He said, "Well, who in the world are you?" I said, "I am the graduate professor of exegetical theology." And he went on, 5. But my job is to talk on the moral aspects of warfare. Somebody might say, "Well, that ought to be a very short speech. You cannot talk about ethics or moral principles in connection with warfare." There are such people. They will tell you, "Well, you can talk about ethics all you wish. You can talk about warfare for hours, but you can't combine the two into one discussion." Well, I should like to say that this is an oversimplification of reality. The basic presupposition is false. The man who begins at this base starts with a general assumption, and I've heard him say this, all war is evil. And he says it in terms of a syllogism, which goes like this: all war is evil. Nobody ought to engage in evil, therefore one ought not to take up arms. I should like to suggest that the assumption is false, especially for us Christians who know reality very well, because there are very few human actions of any kind, especially when it comes to nations, which are good. The actual choice you have in existence is between what is less evil than some other course of action. And right at the beginning here, I should like to put down the proposition that sometimes engaging in war is less evil than some other course of action. There come moments in history when it is not only possible, but imperative to support war as an act of conscience. The people who trouble me very much are conscientious objectors, not because I disrespect their position, I respect it very highly and we need them, but because very often they operate on the presupposition that they are the only people who have a conscience. And when they come to me, one of the first things we've got to clear away is this particular point, that I too have a conscience. I have a conscience that's terribly sensitive to what would happen if we should withdraw from Vietnam too quickly, because I know what would happen. There would be a bloodbath, the like of which we haven't heard of for many years. There come times when warfare is less evil than something else. That's why we took up arms against the Nazis, because the kind of regime with which they threatened humanity was very, very evil indeed. That's the first point I want to make about those who oversimplify things. The second is that very often the pacifist, if we may use that term rather loosely at the moment, does not really understand the role of force as distinguished from violence, the role of force in sustaining the structures of existence. The man who does not believe in force will soon be a slave, because we happen to live in the kind of world where you cannot have peace without force, because there are evil men in the world who cannot be stopped in any other way except by the controlled application of force. Sometimes this happens within a nation, that the military is called upon to do its job, namely to be the instrument of controlled application of force. Little Rock, Arkansas was such an example. Here we got all gummed up on the problem of school integration. In fact, it became so complicated and so complex that President Eisenhower had to call the paratroopers to help solve this social problem. That's one reason a nation has a military establishment, because there are such junctures in existence, especially when it comes to the relationship of nations with each other. Now, if we did not live in a multi-state system, where every nation is all the time trying to gather more power to itself, perhaps the potentials of evil would be less. But we're not there yet. We're not there yet. Maybe we will someday. In the meantime, the best thing that can happen to the world is for the United States to be strong enough for regional clusters of nations to develop, out of which there may eventually come some kind of world government, if that is really what we want. Now, when the moment comes for a nation to use its military, it puts its troops on the line. And we create our military up to this point by selective service, the philosophy behind which is very simple, namely that the defense of the nation is the responsibility of every citizen. But since national defense is not just a matter of taking up weapons, but involves such things as research, economic resources, and who knows what, therefore, by selective service, we say this man takes up the uniform, that man is exempt. And I'm fully aware of many of the injustices that have developed under the system. Yet the philosophy of it is that under the Constitution of the United States, the defense of this nation is the responsibility of the militia. And the militia is specifically defined as every male citizen between the age of 17 and 45. Now, it would be folly to draft everyone, because there are many more sides to national defense today than military operations. Once a nation has committed its troops, then the individual soldier, airman, sailor faces a very raw question, and I'm going to put it to you as raw as it comes. The question is it ever right to kill a human being in battle? That's the way the issue comes to you when you are in uniform and on the battlefield. Now, to weigh this question intelligently and to come up with some kind of principles, let me talk about the question in terms of its source, its context, and then try to set forth certain principles. The last thing I would want to do is to give the impression that I was providing some kind of school answer. I'm not. You still have to weigh the individual factors and make up your own mind, as I've had to make up mine. But I've noted that not too many people have the wherewithal to make up their mind. They haven't ever sat down, for instance, to figure out the principles in that other institution whose name escapes me at the moment. It's in Missouri. Students come to me and they say, I'm against Vietnam, it's immoral. I said, well, now that's very interesting. How do you come to that conclusion? Have you ever asked yourself what a just war is? The seven questions. Well, no, they hadn't heard about a one, you see. So how can you make up your mind, you see, unless you have considered every aspect of a particular problem? And my purpose is to set forth a kind of context in which this is possible. So, number one, the first section on source. I believe it is very significant that the question comes to us and to the man in uniform as a problem in conscience. There have been many periods in history and many cultures in which this was not a problem in conscience. This was not a conscience issue among the ancient Greeks in the days of Pericles or Homer, for that matter. They talked about the tragedy of it, and Euripides has a marvelous play on that point, but they never discuss it in terms of moral right and wrong. They just felt, well, this is part of the burden of existence. It came up as a problem in conscience, especially in Judaism of the first century BC. Julius Caesar was wise enough to see the dimensions of the problem, so he exempted all Jewish males from service in the Roman army. There were other side problems connected with this, for instance, their dietary regulations and the kind of kitchens you have to establish to meet these dietary requirements. But it was mostly a matter of conscience and his respect for conscience. Fortunately, there were enough people around from other tribes able to defend the borders of the empire against the invaders. And by the time then Julius Caesar and the Senate party got through with their little war, their civil war, and Augustus became emperor, he continued the policy of Julius Caesar, and it was possible for one period in history to have 90 years of peace because the Roman army was strong. This spilled over into the church fathers. They discussed military service. Of course, they were troubled by the commandment, thou shalt not kill, but very often they introduced the other item of idolatry. For when you entered the Roman army, you had to burn a pinch of incense to the statue of Caesar, and Tertullian particularly discusses this in terms of idolatry, and says it is not possible for a Christian to be in military service because he has to do this act of idolatry. Very often, of course, it was the commandment, thou shalt not kill. But by the time St. Augustine came around, and the barbarians were threatening the Roman Empire, he wrote to Count Boniface, who was the commander of Roman troops in North Africa, because this count had decided to leave the military service and enter the church. He wrote to Count Boniface suggesting that probably he could do much more good to humanity by staying in the military. And then he observed, I like this sentence, we must not before the time live with the saints alone. In the Middle Ages, we got the peace of God, an instrument by which the number of persons was limited who could engage in a specific conflict. Then came the truce of God, which eliminated or ordered to be eliminated all conflict between Saturday evening and Monday morning, and the same would apply to the holidays. And by the time you had 151 holidays plus 52 Sundays, you had quite a bit of the year during which people could not fight. Well, you know men well enough to realize what happened is that they fought more ferociously in the open season than they might otherwise have done. Jumping quickly to the past generation, past century, in the Geneva Convention, some of these principles are reflected. Three things specifically ought to be mentioned, namely that medics were to be considered as non-combatants, the wounded were to be treated humanely, and any civilians who volunteer to help in the care of the wounded should be considered as neutral. Now, of course, this convention was adopted when it was very easy to draw a line between combatants and non-combatants. That time is past. When the airplane was invented, the cities were exposed, and the centers of our culture lay open to view. Then we developed nuclear power, and John Foster Dulles could threaten the enemy with such talk as reducing his country to a howling wilderness. But remember the reaction, those of us who are older will remember. The American people rejected this kind of talk about indiscriminate destruction. Because you see, into our culture there has been built a concern for right, which brings about the fact that the problem of killing in battle is a matter of conscience. We are not about, as American people, we are not about to approve the indiscriminate use of force. That's why, for instance, we engage in a limited war in Vietnam, much to the handicap of the troops that are there. And out of this tradition of ours, there has developed the doctrine of the just war. Now, as Lutherans, we have a particular responsibility in this area because our Lutheran confessions operate with the notion of the just war and the seven criteria which are used to determine what a just war is, and I'll just read them real fast. Is a particular conflict being waged under legitimate authority? Is there a moral purpose involved? Is there perhaps excessive violence? What will be the conditions after the war? Will they be better than if no war had been waged? Have all other means been exhausted to solve a particular problem? Is there selective immunity? Are arrangements made, for instance, to avoid wholesale slaughter? And finally, when it is all over, will there be a restoration into the moral order? And on the basis of this kind of background, where right is still an item in the exercise of force, our previous Secretary of Defense, Mr. McNamara, developed two doctrines on which we still operate. Namely, the doctrine of controlled response, which means we're going to ride out a nuclear attack and not be the first to attack. We will counterattack in counterforce, not in terms of the enemy cities, and we're going to avoid a hair trigger response. The second doctrine is that of conventional option, which means that the decision to use tactical nuclear weapons will not be forced upon us. We hope never to have to use them. We're never going to act from panic, but only as a matter of deliberate choice. Because, you see, in our culture there is the awareness that wholesale destruction is immoral. And that testifies to the importance of the right, in the affairs of men. You may be sure that this was not a problem for Genghis Khan or Joseph Stalin. He never worried about the question, is it right to kill a human being in battle? Because these men did not view life as a gift the way you and I do. So much for the source, the second point, the context. The question doesn't come to us out of the blue. We live in a particular historical context which has its own peculiarities and characteristics. In this particular context where we now live in 1969, nothing less is at stake in the present conflict than the future of mankind, especially the concept of freedom. This is at the heart of the whole problem. It is no fake issue, as people on the other side of the Iron Curtain know very well. And let me give you two examples. Evtushenko, the Roman, the Russian poet, was here 3 years ago, 1966. He got to see many things, also the Blue Fox Farms in Alaska. And when he got back, he wrote what is called the Monologue of a Blue Fox on an Alaskan Farm. And it's a very interesting piece, and is a devastating satire on a totalitarian system. It's a description of the fox, the blue fox in his cage, howling, shrieking, he wants a change of fur, or he wants his freedom. He doesn't like this thing of anticipating that he's going to be skinned and then his fur will be sold. Well, one night he finds that the cage door is open, and so he slinks out to experience freedom. A week later, he's tired of freedom. He's tired of the business of having to make up his own mind. He discovers the burden of liberty, and so he sneaks back into the cage and pulls the door shut. And then he says to himself, the blue fox, a creature born in a cage is no longer fit for the burden of freedom. The next item is The Dragon, a play. This is the first play shown on this side of the Iron Curtain, but written on the other side. My wife and I saw this in Paris in June of 1966. It's known as The Dragon. Was done by an East German, Eugenie Schwartz. It's a very simple story, fairy story. It tells of a country that has been under the control of a dragon for years and years and years. A knight on white horseback comes riding across the stage like St. George to do battle with this monster. He wants to set these people free, only to discover they don't want this. They have been reduced to the point where they prefer servitude. They have lived so long in an anthill type of society that they have become less than human beings. They don't want the burden of personal choice. Now, the point of both of these is very obvious. Given enough time, it is possible with modern technology, the business of taking a man's soul apart and putting it together again, and the mass media, it is possible, given enough time, to reduce people to being less than what their creator intended them to be. And whenever that happens, you have the demonic at work in the social order. Now, admittedly, we have many demonic forces in a technological society, also over here in America. But I would like to propose that the demonic is especially incarnate in the Marxist movement of our day. Why? Well, consider what is at stake, the whole concept of freedom. There are three notions of freedom abroad today. One of them, unhappily, is on our side. It's the notion that freedom is my right to do as I jolly well please. Well, that's not freedom, that's license. Freedom is always limited. It is always channeled, the way a river is channeled. As soon as it breaks out of its banks, it's destructive. That's not the notion of freedom on which our country has been built. Another notion is the totalitarian one, namely that freedom is my responsibility to do what I must do. And how do I know what I must do? The party tells me. That's its job. It has been given the assignment under the Marxist system to analyze the historical context where people live and then to prescribe. And the only job I have as a subject in that way of life is to say, yes, I'll do it. I have an aunt who lives in East Germany, and a couple of summers ago I saw her. She was visiting her son, my cousin, over in Buckum, Germany, which is in the west. He fled from the east. And she said to me one day, you have no idea of what it means to live in a totalitarian society. And I said, that's true, I don't really. Well, she said, use this particular yardstick and reflect on it. Imagine yourself living in a society where everything not specifically commanded is prohibited. That's the way we live in East Germany. Where everything not specifically commanded is prohibited. I hear among our students the nonsense that life in the ghetto is like living in Czechoslovakia, than which there is no bigger baloney, I would say. to say. Because to live in Czechoslovakia today is to live where everything not specifically commanded by the party is prohibited, and Dubček can give you a long speech on that one. This is an interpretation of reality which is quite the reverse of the Christian interpretation, the biblical one. And so we get to the third notion of freedom, which is the one on which our country was built up. I don't want to suggest that this is necessarily totally Christian. It is the kind of notion about freedom that would develop in a culture heavily indebted to Christian values. This is the concept of freedom as my responsibility, my opportunity to do what I ought to be doing. And you know, when I say that, I'm implying two things. Number one, that I've got the job of choice, that's what the word opportunity is about, that I am a person, for that's what a person is, a being with the faculty of choice. And secondly, that there is a set of moral principles which is entirely independent of the historical context where an individual happens to be living. That's what we've been saying in our traditions in America, that freedom is the opportunity to do what one ought to be doing, fully recognizing that we are not always up to that ideal. This is part of human existence, that you're constantly working against the evil that is still there. But this notion of freedom, and here I'm taking three ideas from James Truslow Adams' famous essay on freedom back in 1938, when the Nazis were threatening the world. This notion of freedom is derived from man's nature, his need, and his destiny. Let's think about three of these items. It is related to man's nature. What is man? Is he just a thing? Is he like a bar of gold which loses its value when it sinks to the bottom of the ocean because you can't use it? Of course not. In our culture, and this is highly Christian in background, man is of value even when he is useless. Think of the billions of dollars we spend each year on old people who are like vegetables in nursing homes. Why don't we let them die? Because man is not a thing. Furthermore, man needs freedom as part of his working climate. The most despicable thing that happens behind the Iron Curtain is the attempt to reduce man's need, to reduce him to being a thing. You cannot grow an oak tree in a 2-gallon pail. Either the pail will burst or the tree will shrivel. You cannot keep a human being as a person unless he has enough opportunity for choice. And that's our quarrel about the ghettos, you see. Because some of these people do not have enough room for choice to be persons. The most eloquent individual that ever wrote on this subject was Dostoevsky. He described life in Siberia, where he didn't have one choice to make. He put on the set of clothes that was left over. He ate what was put before him. And even when he and his comrades went out to fell trees, he discovered that the trees had already been marked by somebody else. They didn't even have that choice to make. And so the title of the book very significantly is The House of the Dead. Of course, these people walked around a while and felled a few trees. But as persons, they were dead because the opportunity of choice had been taken away. This is also related to man's destiny. If you and I live only 70 or 80 years, or 90 maybe, and that's the end, then of course government, the state which outlasts us, is more important. Then it does have the right to decide on the ultimate issues of life, because it is more significant. But if you and I have an eternal destiny, which is what we believe according to our Christian faith, then there are certain rights about us, as Jefferson put it in the Declaration of Independence, that no state can either give or take away. They are unalienable: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Then the business of the state can never, dare never enter into the ultimate problems of man's individual existence. It is primarily the second and the third notions of freedom which are in contest in the present conflict that rages throughout the world, whether we like it or not. And what we are trying to do on our side is to keep the demonic forces at work in our total world society from accomplishing their ends, reducing all mankind to the level of George Orwell's Animal Farm. That's the context. Now let's lay down a few principles while we're in this business. Principles that need to be considered before you decide, ethically I mean now, what your particular stance is. The first thing, perhaps, that we need to say, although we take it for granted very often, is that life is a gift. Now, that in itself is a tremendous insight, which comes to us especially from the biblical revelation, where we are put into confrontation with our Creator and Redeemer. That life is a gift. The Greeks never realized that. We do. It is a gift, and therefore to be used like any other gift from God. It may be given away. And when you do that, you are engaging in the most important ethical job of sacrificing, as our Lord offered himself, giving his life for ours. The sergeant who throws himself on a bomb to save the lives of the men in his unit is doing something noble. It is ethically right for him to do so. He is a hero to us because of his sacrificial act. Next, life being a gift is something to be defended and protected, especially if it is the other man's life. This is a good Christian New Testament approach. In fact, there come moments when it is immoral not to defend the other man's life. And that applies not only on an individual level, but also among nations. Let me give you just one sentence from Paul Ramsey's great book on the just war. Anyone who is impressed only by the immorality and probable ineffectiveness of interventionary action should sensitize his conscience to the immorality and probable ineffectiveness of non-intervention. That can also be very immoral. You remember the case of Kitty Genovese in New York, who screamed for help when she was being bludgeoned to death out there in the courtyard of an apartment building? The reaction was that 38 people closed their windows and closed shut their shutters. And there was an outcry in America over this callous indifference, this unwillingness to get involved in the defense of somebody's life. And thank goodness for the outcry, because it was an exhibit of the fact that deep down underneath we still feel there is something wrong about not defending somebody else's life. Next, and here is an area where there is a considerable hang-up in our day. We hear it said that we must love our neighbor as ourselves. Of course that's right. Who could quarrel with it, since it is the word of the Lord? But there is another step to this. In life, we have various kinds of responsibilities, and so the exercise of love is done on the principle of justice, the distribution of love according to the various relationships in which we live. Very simple example. If a thug should enter my living room and threaten my family, I have a set of responsibilities toward my family in terms of love that is of greater importance than my responsibility toward the thug whom I'm also to love. Well, apply this to the field of international relations and my individual responsibility. My relationship to the North Vietnamese soldier is not a one-to-one affair. In between are two sets of loyalties, mine to my country and his to his. I have a responsibility toward my country which outranks my concern for his, and that's true on his side. Now, when he is wounded, and when he is in need of my help, then once more he becomes my neighbor in the New Testament ethical sense. The one-to-one relationship returns. And you better carry out the words of the Lord at the end of the story of the Good Samaritan. You go and do likewise. Next, and this is point four. A good many people cite the commandment, thou shalt not kill, and I'm very grateful they do, because it means they're still somewhat interested in the biblical revelation. But it is a very misleading thing to quote this commandment offhand without reflecting on what it really means. It so happens that there are six words in the Old Testament for killing, and the one that is in the commandment never occurs when the Old Testament is talking about warfare. Now that ought to have some significance for anyone who's seriously concerned about biblical interpretation. As a matter of fact, if you want this whole thing concentrated in one passage, just look up 1 Kings 2:5, where David gives the orders to his new commander-in-chief to do Joab in. Why? Because Joab had been guilty of killing people in times of peace. That was wrong. Not in times of war. 1 Kings 2:5. Check it for yourself. It's a long verse, but I think you can stand reading it. Then there's the instance of Abraham, asked to sacrifice his son Isaac. You see, the Creator, the lawgiver, is above the law. He gave it. The commandment itself is not absolute in the strict sense. Now, don't misunderstand me. The Creator is. And he has himself revealed that there are occasionally exceptions under his rule. Here was one of them. There were the cities of refuge to which you could go and have the case decided whether a man was guilty of homicide or murder. Why was this opportunity given? Because there was this recognition in the Old Testament revelation of the difference between the two. Now, if you should ask why the Israelites were asked to destroy every Amalekite, man, woman, and child, the answer must be understood in terms of God's holiness. He is not one who will brook resistance. It takes him a little longer nowadays to do people in who reject him. There was a shortcut among the Israelites. It was done on the spur of the moment. But the principle is the same. Those who reject the God of life will die. Now, an exception is made to the commandment, to the literal sense of the commandment, when mankind is threatened by forces that blatantly boast they will negate the will of the Creator wherever they get control. The kind of utopia in reverse, where truth is a lie, and freedom is tyranny, and democracy is turned into dictatorship, and man becomes a thing. The exception arises when a sovereign nation, through its responsible people, decides the moment has come when all other solutions have been exhausted and we must apply force in a controlled way to solve a great problem. And that brings me to point five, and I'm especially happy about this because I'm talking to a group of Lutherans. I can't say this everywhere because As soon as you talk about the distinction between law and gospel, you've got the whole crowd lost. But the law and gospel is a very honorable and ancient Lutheran distinction. And one of the things that you and I can contribute to our society, because it will keep people from becoming schizophrenic, trying to figure out what's going on. Under law and gospel, we understand two kingdoms of God, the kingdom of power and the kingdom of grace. These two kingdoms, although they are run by the same Lord, our Lord Jesus Christ, operate on two different principles. The kingdom of power, as the word suggests, is held together by force. The relationship of nations toward each other is one of power. And it is confusing, law and gospel, these two kingdoms, when someone comes along to say that nations ought to be run by grace, by forgiveness. This is the business of the church. And so St. Paul's symbol for government is the sword, not the chalice. And he's very specific in Romans 13 in saying that government has the job of using the sword when necessary. Responsibly, of course, but not to get itself mixed up with what is the job of the church. Now, how does this apply? Let me give you a very simple example. Under law, in the kingdom of power, national self-interest, which of course is involved all the time, and I don't want to make any bones about that, national self-interest is a good thing, while under gospel, it is wrong. Now, unless you keep these two things apart, and realize that nations are not run like the church, you're going to go mad. Because you will see that it is impossible. In fact, that it is destructive and anarchic to apply to nations the principle of the gospel. There is no way in which you could produce anarchy faster than to eliminate it. The use of force, because it so happens that in our evil existence, and that's the problem, you see, evil, our fallen existence, it so happens that there are these demonic forces which cannot be stopped any other way than by force. And if you want some wholesome commentary on that, I should like to suggest Luther's explanation of the petition, "Give us this day our daily bread," as he has it in his large catechism. This is very contemporary. There is a drive on in our days to suggest that peace is the best of all possible conditions. This may not be a fact. Peace, of course, is desirable under normal circumstances. But there is a kind of peace which is worse than warfare. That's why we took up arms against the Nazis, because we didn't want the peace of the cemetery imposed on us. Today we live under the threat of universal tyranny, and don't make any mistake about that. And the situation may well develop where it would be immoral not to engage in conflict. And as you ponder and reflect on these principles, remember that the vision and purpose of the United States is to create a world order where security, stability, and development apply. Development is a recognition of the fact that you and I and everybody else is a person with a right to freedom, the opportunity to make personal choices. Well, is it right ever to take the life of a human being in battle? And I guess, in summary, my answer would be there are times when it is not only necessary, but when it is good, in the sense of being less evil than something else, not in the absolute sense. We would betray millions today if we did not stand up and get counted against this tyranny. As Kennedy put it in the speech he never got to give in Dallas, this generation of Americans, by destiny and not by choice, is called upon to be the watchmen guarding the bastions of liberty. And as Johnson put it, we did not choose to be the guardian at the gate, but there is no other. We've got this tragic burden, you and I have. Maybe we'd rather not have it, but we've got it. We can bug out on it, or we can see it through. Thank you very much. For laying the questions, issues, theological background before us. And now, as we said, regarding the ground rules, if you have questions or statements, you may rise, ask for the floor, and rise and make them. You need not direct everything to Dr. Charlemagne, or you can go to the microphone, because when the Coordinating Councils Committee and we suggested Dr. Charlemagne would come to our campus and ask us if this might be possible. We stated that, yes, this was a man who was an authority. He has a position on it. And we'd like to have the questions raised and discuss them sensibly as Christian brethren. I heard Dr. Charlemagne present material at the Denver Convention when I was on the floor committee on theological matters, and others spoke too and presented their propositions. So we'd like to have an open dialogue here on the questions and matters before us, because we must discuss them all through our ministry. And I'd like to say, brethren, that whether we have disagreement of a opinion or not on some of these matters, and I do not know where the disagreement always lies, let us remember that it isn't only that which is our concern here at this seminary. Our concern is also what you will do when you must minister to others and with us and work with us who have opinions differing from yours. And how you can handle this situation here before you go out to work with others. So now we are ready for someone. Professor Boltz, you want to do it from, speak loudly if you do it from where you are, please. Okay. Well, we will Vietnamize the war. I think I can say that very categorically.
But supposing we can.
We will. We'll do it as we did in South Korea, making a viable nation. It may take us a while. It has already taken a while to do it, but it will be done. The next point is we will not let Southeast Asia fall. I think I can say that definitely. And for a very good reason. Suppose, I like to put it this way, suppose you were the President of the United States and you knew a number of things, as Nixon does. One, that our economy is built around 91 strategic elements, that only 11 of these are available in sufficient supply for easy access, that the rest, many of the rest, are in Southeast Asia, If we could not get them, we would have wholesale unemployment in 5-6 years. What do you suppose the President of the United States is going to decide? He's committed to the welfare of this nation. I'm sorry, this is assuming an outcome that I don't believe is really viable. We are going to Vietnamize that war. Mr. Boddy?
Dr. Sherman, I have a question I'd like to propose. First of all, I think you made the statement earlier in your lecture that without Vietnam, the future of mankind is at stake. My question is, how do you know that the future of mankind is at stake in South Vietnam?
And the second, what's the second question?
Second question is your comment later in the lecture that the purpose of the United States is to create a world order with reference to world security. And I would like you, if you would, to tell us where in the writings of the founding fathers of the country and in the Declaration of Independence and Constitution that you find the kind of purpose stated.
Well, let me just hurry and answer that second one. This is the contemporary policy. The State Department and the President, within a living context, choose different objectives depending upon what age in history we're living in. This is our contemporary purpose, to provide a world, although it's inherent in what our founding fathers said, to provide a world of security, stability, development. The question of security didn't really develop among our founding fathers. It did when the Marines were organized to fight the Barbary pirates in the Mediterranean. Their insecurity developed, and we clobbered them real fast to restore security. The whole notion of development is a recent one because of the nature of the ideological conflict in which we are engaged, where the Marxist purpose, of course, is to deprive people of development in the sense in which we understand it. Well, that's the second question, and I'm not so sure I could say much more on that point. These are ongoing interpretations of our basic national stance, the very kind of thing we do in theology, where we take the principles and reapply them. For instance, it hasn't been until after World War II that our policy has been to keep any section of the world from falling under the control of one individual, like, let's say, Mao Zedong in Southeast Asia. That's one. Number two, I think I was trying to say, and maybe it didn't come out that way, that Vietnam is part of a larger struggle in which we are engaged almost everywhere around the world. But it is part of that struggle. It is, in essence, the same kind of thing, where we are trying to prevent the imposition of a communist order on a certain area of the world, a geographical area. And our purpose specifically is to create the kind of conditions where the South Vietnamese can determine their own form of government. Now, this is to a certain degree a matter of risk, but you know there isn't any place in the world which has ever voluntarily chosen communism. And we're taking that chance, that once these people understand something of freedom, they will appreciate it, and they do now, by the way, very much. Why do you suppose 1 million of them fled North Vietnam? Because they knew what was coming. We have a commitment to them that they shall be secure and safe. My conscience begins to bother me very much when we start talking about bugging out. Because we've got a job. We made a commitment to 1 million fellow Christians, primarily, that they would be allowed to live in safety and security. Now let's see, what was the heart of that first question? Will you pose it again?
You mentioned that the future of mankind.
Yes, yes. All right. Okay. Yes. Yeah, because right. Because the issue is between two notions of freedom, primarily. And that is involved in Vietnam, it is involved in North Africa, in Africa, it is involved.